Okay. So we'll start out by talking about mantle plumes and how they're different from mid-ocean ridges. And we'll talk about the effect of water. There's been a lot of discussion about water and how it can solve everything. You don't have to have the mantle hot. You put a little bit of water in it and you get as much melt as you want. It's also true to some degree about peroxenite veins. I want to go over this phase equilibrium thing so that you have a picture, a very simple picture of what goes on in at least the upper part of the mantle with regard to how the minerals behave when the melting happens. And then hopefully we'll have time to talk at least briefly about melt percolation models and how those come into play, how the melt actually gets through and out. If we look at a plume, and we can take Hawaii as an example since we have some kind of a dynamical model for it. These are some of the things that cause confusion. How big is it? And it has several different sizes. You could talk about the width of the temperature anomaly. You could talk about the width of the upwelling velocity anomaly. You could talk about the width of the melting region, which is sort of what we see at the surface, is where there's volcanoes. And then the widths of any geochemical heterogeneities in the plume may not correspond to any of these things. They may be something separate. And then, of course, the plume has a particular diameter down in the, when it's coming through the middle part of the mantle, and when it gets up underneath the lithosphere, it tends to spread out. And so there's changes in that as well. And then this question about how hot it is and why do we think so. These things I've mentioned before, but we're going to go through them in a little bit more detail. So last time I showed you this diagram, and this will be the basis of what we're going to do again, which shows the sort of average solidus for mantle layers of light. This is based on Hirschman's compilation, 2000 publication, and shows what you get for different potential temperatures if you have upwelling, adiabatically upwelling mantle material, where it crosses the solidus and what happens to it after it crosses the solidus and how much melt you produce. And the main difference between having something coming up in the old lithosphere versus at a mid-ocean ridge is that you're limited in how far up toward the surface you can advect material, and this means that you can only get things to melt if they're hot, hotter than the average stuff that comes up under mid-ocean ridges. Okay. There's currently only one published model that deals with Hawaii, and I don't know that there's another one that deals with any other plume in any detail. This was based on a dynamical model by Reby and Christensen in 1994, which they then added melting to in 1999. And this is what their model box looks like. It's 400 kilometers thick. It's got a lithosphere. The lithosphere is moving at an imposed velocity, which is supposed to correspond to the Pacific plate. And the hot material is generated at the bottom of their box by basically a little hot plate. You generates an upwelling, and then they can follow what happens to it as it interacts with the lithosphere. This shows an example of what the potential temperature is at a depth of 110 kilometers. So this shows half, you know, the one half of the plan view, and you can see how this thing spreads out. It has a kind of parabolic shape. Well, it turns out that Louis Marazzi and other people have identified this too, that you get little rolls, convection rolls in the thing, depending on exactly how you choose the parameters. And there are some aspects of this model that have turned out to be artifacts, but we'll get to those in a minute. So if you look along the axis of the plume in the direction that the lithosphere is moving, they've got this graph in the paper, which shows at the top the potential temperature, and they don't have it going all the way down the background. This is only going from 1600 to 1430. They assume that the background mantle had a potential temperature of 1300, so this shows only the upper sort of half of the temperature range. These are flow lines. Only three. This shows the melting rate in the plume. So it melts in this little region here that's kind of conical at the bottom and dome-shaped at the top. And this is the total amount, integrated amount of melting that occurs, and the total amount gets up too close to 20%. One of the things that turned out to be a mistake is this resurgence of melting over here, which I'm not sure exactly what the problem was. I think it had to do with effects of the sides of the box. The plate, we'll talk about the plate. This is their stand, their sort of best fit model, and it's the plate is about, it's on another, I think it's 80 kilometers. Okay, so what did they do? So they generated the plume with this radial thermal anomaly at the bottom of the box, which has a sort of Gaussian shape, and that Gaussian shape pretty much applies to the plume itself as it's coming up. And at about 170 kilometers depth, which is the bottom of this cross section here, the scale length is about 65 kilometers, so that the temperature drops off by 1 over E at a radius of 65 kilometers, and the maximum potential temperature excess is 300K in their model. It's actually 292 or something like that. These values depend in detail on the viscosity structure of the plume, but I've actually played with this a little bit, and you can't change them all that much. You can make the plume a little skinnier, and you can make the or a little wider, and you can make the potential temperature a little bit different, but there are some constraints that you have to meet, and it doesn't allow you to change it all that much. It doesn't change the conclusions in any case. So the width of the thermal anomaly at 170 kilometers is about 130 kilometers. That's 2 times 65 kilometers. And the constraints that they used are the buoyancy flux, the height to width ratio of the Hawaiian swell, and the rate of magma production.
Yeah. The thermal anomaly, like, assume the plate motion.
Yeah.
But you have something that extends to the left.
Oh,
is
yeah.
Well,
initially the thing is going to try to spread both directions. Yeah. Actually, this I think is a bit of an artifact also of their box being too small. The edge of the box on this side is not far enough away, and so their code drives the convection down here more than it should. So Matthew Jell's redone this part of it, and he doesn't get that effect so much. It looks more, there's less of a wing out here, and it goes mostly that way. So this is a bit of an illustration of the data, okay, that they're trying to fit. This is a picture of the Hawaiian swell where they've sort of marked in where the boundaries of it are. This is the excess topography that you get in the Hawaiian swell. And so it goes up fairly steeply on the front side of the plume and then drops off gradually on the back side. This is along the axis, so that would be sort of along here. Okay. And so what the relationships they found by running the model with different parameters are shown on the right side here. So the top is the lithosphere thickness in kilometers, the middle is the thermal part of the buoyancy flux, and the bottom is the viscosity in the core of the plume. Okay, so the other thing that they're trying to fit is the total magma production rate, which they need to produce the Hawaiian Ridge. So there's an excess amount of material there, and so that's the other thing that they're trying to fit. So this dot represents what they consider their best model, which ends up with a lithosphere that's about 85 kilometers thick, a buoyancy flux that's a little over 3 megagrams per second, and a viscosity that's a little under 10 to the 18th Pascal seconds for the middle part of the plume, and a potential temperature in the plume of about 1590 or 1592 or something like that. So you can see that if you if you decrease the thickness of the lithosphere, you can decrease the corresponding decrease in the potential temperature maximum that you need in order to generate the same amount of melting. Okay. Sleep and Davies did it wrong. A factor of 2. Yeah. So they, first of all, it turns out that when you, and this is something that, you know, we could, you could check. You could check it with Lars's model. They, when they put the melting in the model, they realized that the total buoyancy flux is 25% due to depletion caused by melting, okay, and 75% thermal. So the thermal part of the flux is only 3 megagrams per second. The other problem is that Davies and Sleep assumed that the plume was being dragged along at the same velocity as the plate. And I think that the explanation is that the actual coupling is not so good, and the plume actually moving at half the velocity of the plate, and that's where the factor of 2 comes in. They explain this in the paper. Okay, it's worth reading this paper, even if they did it wrong. You see where the issues are. Okay, so anyway, they liked it here because they got the right amount of melting, and they got they didn't want the plume viscosity to be too high. There's another constraint on the plume viscosity they claim in this paper. I've talked to some other people, and they claim that it's not a constraint, and that is that the profile of the Hawaiian swell, they've parameterized it in terms of a ratio of its height to its width. If the plume is very low viscosity, it spreads out quickly in the asthenosphere, and you end up with a wider, thinner topographic swell. And if it's too high viscosity, you end up with not as wide and thicker swell. And so they claim that you have to have the viscosity down here in the 10 to the 8 range or a little bit below, and that's about, you can't go below that at any rate. So this is drove them to this model with that lithosphere thickness and that potential temperature. Now the potential temperature is also, because it's determined by the amount of melting, depends on where you have the solidus of the mantle material, and you can wiggle that a little bit. Okay. All right. So in their model, the maximum degree of melting is about 20%. So if you follow the axial material in the plume, it gets up to about 19 or 20% when it's melted as far as it's going to go. And the melting rate, you can see here, goes to zero at about 90 kilometers depth for the material that's coming up along the axis of the plume. And for the material that's coming out a little bit on the edge that just grazes the melting region, that stuff never melts at depths less than 120 kilometers. Okay, so that's where the dynamical picture has to be taken into account, not just the thickness of the lithosphere. Yeah. You mean why these things are closer together up here?
Yeah.
That's because it's spreading out, I think, you know, in the other direction.
Do you mean that it's closer to the top?
Yeah, the top's thinner
than the bottom. Oh, you mean why this distance is different from this distance? Yeah, it's just, what? Yeah, that could be it. I'm not sure. Okay, so the width of their melting region, you can see it on here, from about here to here, is about 120 kilometers. So that's the full width, and if you compare that to the width of the thermal anomaly, it's about one-third the radius of the thermal anomaly, because the thermal anomaly is already increased in radius as it's coming up under the plume. So only the central part of the plume is melting. They got about, if you guess at their upwelling velocities, they never mentioned it in the paper, it's about 30 or 35 centimeters per year in the center of the plume. The upwelling rate, the plume width, and the temperature are all interrelated, as I mentioned. These relationships and the effects of the assumptions about mantle rheology You get some idea of these from the paper by Howry et al. In 1994. There are a couple of other, I think this probably is still the most complete one, where they looked at the parameter dependences. But like I said, it turns out that you can't change the parameters all that much from what Reby and Christensen did. If you superimpose their total amount of melt production on the island of Hawaii at the appropriate scale, this is what it might look like. Now, I've arranged it here in a way that I think makes some sense, where Lu'ihi, which is drifting onto the melting anomaly here, hasn't been over the melting anomaly very long because it's pretty small. Mauna Loa is up here because we know that it's starting to shut off. Its eruption rate is going down. Kilauea is closest to the center, and actually if you follow the magma track, it comes up somewhere down here and then goes, has some horizontal component to it, ends up over at the summit over there. So this is might be what it looks like now and what the scale would be. Interestingly, if you plot after the volcanoes drift off the main melting region, the melting rate goes way down, and under those conditions, for reasons that we'll talk about in a little while, you expect to get alkali basalt as well as a much lower magma flux. And when you look at the post-shield alkali centers and their distribution on the Big Island, they're out there beyond this region where the melt production rate has dropped off a lot, which is what you would expect. Okay, and just again, for an idea of scale, the full width of the thermal anomaly, this is 2 sigma width at 170 kilometer depth, would be this. And the material that melts has this diameter. So you're only melting that middle part. Okay, so why are you only melting that middle part? This is another version of the melting diagram. And this assumes, again, no water. And if you put these limits where the core of the plume makes it up to 90 kilometers depth while it's still melting, and the edges of the melting region only make it to 120, in order to get to 20% melting, you have to start back here at a potential temperature around 1600 or 1590. And at the edge of the plume, it's even hotter than we would have guessed if it came all the way up to 90 kilometers. So the edge of the melting region has a potential temperature up here that's maybe 1520 or something like that, or 1530. So the range of potential temperatures of the material that actually melts is between about 1590 and about 1530. So and this temperature is fairly high because the stuff at the edge turns off to the side at a greater depth than what's in the core of the plume. So this is the reason, you know, this diagram essentially explains why the plume has to be 1600 degrees C or 1580 or something like that in the core in order to generate enough magma to produce the islands, the volcanoes. So on this diagram, which shows the melt fraction or the extent of melting as a function of pressure, the core of the plume is on this track. It's coming up just above 1580 and reaches about 20% melt at a depth, well, at about 30 kilobars, which is as far as it gets. And the edge of the melting region just sort of shows up here. It only makes it to about 40 kilobars pressure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had to get the buoyancy flux. The buoyancy flux, the height to width ratio of the Hawaiian swell, the magma production, and what was the other thing? Those were the main three things. Yeah, it's very easy to calculate the buoyancy flux if you assume that you've got a Gaussian temperature distribution. And if you look at the models for the relationship between temperature, viscosity, and upwelling velocity, you can actually write a fairly simple relationship. You can't make the plume a lot narrower because if you cut it down a lot, you basically have to have a very high it has to have a very low viscosity to be that small. It has to be moving very fast in order to get the buoyancy flux. And then they say that you can't fit the shape of the Hawaiian swell with it. Okay. And by the way, when Matthew Jull redid this, that didn't change. Basically, that part of the model didn't change. Okay, so what happens if you add water? How much difference is that going to make? Well, here's one representation of what the effect of water is on melting in the mantle. So this is the melting temperature of the mantle at one pressure, one GPA, for a particular composition that actually starts melting at a especially low temperature. So if it has no water, it starts melting here. If it has 1/10 of a weight percent water, the initial melting temperature is way over here somewhere. And if you add 2% water, it makes it even lower. So water allows you to start melting at a lower temperature. But once you get up to the temperature range where you would normally have started melting, the melting relations are not too much different. We can skip that one. If we look at it in another view, this shows you actually how much effect water can have, although it has this kind of a strange net effect that's not as big as you would expect. So this is now the melting curve. This is the solidus, the dry solidus of larzolite here. This is the one that cats at all use, which is a few tens of degrees lower than the Hirschman one. These are data from the literature, there aren't very many, of where melting occurs if you have excess water. You have so much water that you'll have an excess water-rich fluid phase in your experiment if you do the melting experiment. And so basically the melting temperature with excess water doesn't really change much between 0 and 8 GPA. If you restrict the amount of water to a particular bulk percentage by weight, if you have, 0.05 weight percent is this one, so that's 500 ppm. This is 1,000 ppm, and this is 3,000 ppm down here. Okay. So 500 ppm is probably something that might be applicable to the Hawaiian plume. And mid-ocean ridges, they think of as maybe having only a 1 or 200 ppm in it. So you get some depression of the solidus to a lower temperature, but not all that much. And it turns out that it ends up being roughly parallel to the original dry solidus. So cats et al., this is Katz, Spiegelman, and Langmuir, have parameterized the data that's available for dry and wet melting, and this is what they come up with for the difference between wet and dry melting for a range from about 0% water to 200 ppm water. So in terms of the adiabatic trajectories, this is where the dry melting curve is. This is the dry solidus here. So the dry trajectory here would be the one that's farthest to the right. You start melting here and then you end up here on the temperature and pressure diagram. And if with 200 ppm water, you start melting somewhere down here and you cross the dry solidus here, but you end up here on almost the same place. And on the fraction melted versus depth, this shows the same thing. You start melting with 200 ppm water at about 1 GPA deeper, and by the time you get up to 15 or 20% melted, you end up at the same point. So the effect of water, if we just look at this one here, which is a potential temperature of 1450 in their model, that would correspond to about 1500 for Hirschman because the solid is in a different place. So in this range here, you get melt in a region where you wouldn't have otherwise. So with water, you can get small degrees of melting, a couple of percent, at depths that you wouldn't have had melting if you were dry. But if your system is such that you're driving the mantle up to the point where the melt fractions are getting up above 10%, you're not increasing the amount of melting by more than about, you know, say 10%. Instead of having 10% melt at this level, you might have 11% melt. So that's the level of an, you know, effect that the water's having. If you could increase the water content here, and you might make that a 20% effect or even a 30% effect, but it's not like you're going to get a huge amount of magma someplace that you wouldn't have gotten it otherwise. Okay, if we look back at Hawaii and see how much 5 or 700 ppm water would have on the melting, this is schematic, but it's close to being right. So you might be able to drop the core temperature of the plume by 10 or 20 degrees C. That will still get you to 20% melting at 90 kilometers. And the edge of the plume could be significantly cooler because you can get a little bit of melt out there on the edge at a quite a bit lower temperature. Okay, so now you would have the plume with still the core temperature being close to 1600. But the and then the average morb would be somewhere down here, probably in the middle, 1330 or 1350. So you get something like 220 or 240 degrees of excess temperature in the plume core. Okay. This one I showed you once before. This is the analysis by Asimo and Langmuir of how much temperature versus water affects the thickness of oceanic crust you get for this triangle model. They start out with 1300 degrees and no water. This makes 2.8 kilometers thickness of crust. If you increase the temperature to, increase the water content to 750 ppm, which is way beyond what people think is typical for mid-ocean ridges, you can get the crustal thickness up to 3.7 kilometers. Okay, so it doesn't, you know, has about 1 kilometer effect. If you go to 1450 for a potential temperature, then you can generate 10 kilometers of crust. So that makes quite a bit of difference in comparison to 1300 degrees C. But then again, if you add 750 ppm, you change 10.3 into 10.9 kilometers. So this is almost, you know, it's neither here nor there. You know, if you pick something in the middle here, the presence of water in the mantle at the level of about 200 or 300 ppm probably is almost negligible for increasing the amount of oceanic crust that you get. What's happening is that what they've called here, this is, I'll come back to this again, the melt fraction is the average melt fraction for the whole triangle. Okay, so what you've added is a tail down here with a large area that's all real small melt fractions, and you've averaged that in with this other triangle here. So the net result is you've made it, the average melt fraction gets smaller. So that was the other point they made in the paper, that this would look like 13.5% melt, whereas this would look like 9% melt. And they show with some trace element data that that's actually consistent with there being some water there, that the F values that you would guess based on the trace elements come out to be smaller than you would guess otherwise, you know, from a dry model. Okay, I'm not going to talk about arcs in this talk very much, but the other thing that they did in this Katz et al. Paper was to use their parameterization of the effect of water to calculate how much water you had to add to the overlying wedge in a subduction zone in order to generate how much melt. So if you have material that's already at some temperature, like pick 1250 degrees C at 15 kilobars, if it has no water in it, it'll have no melt. If you put in 0.1% water, you'll generate 4% melt. Okay, and similarly with material at other temperatures. So this is the general idea with, it's the ambient understanding of arcs, that what's going on there is you're adding water by subduction to material that's down there that's already hot. Okay. Okay, now, this is the second part of the talk. I want to deal with what happens to the mineralogy of the mantle as you melt. And this goes back partly to this dichotomy that people recognized fairly early on in petrology before they really knew what it meant, and that some basalts they classified as stoliitic and some as alkaline. And the basic difference is in how much available silica the magmas have in them. And so if they're a little bit silica rich, they have the potential to crystallize orthopyroxene in their crystallization sequence. If they're silica poor, they tend to stay away from orthopyroxene, which is a relatively silica-rich mineral, and you never see orthopyroxene in them. So there was some sense that this was important, and it turns out that it has to do with the pressure and the amount of melting that goes on in the mantle. So if you have low pressures of melting and very high melt fractions, you tend to get tholeite. And if you have relatively high pressures and small melt fractions, you get alkali basalt. So those, it turns out to be an important distinction. Andesite is yet another thing that's, and quartz tholeitic basalt that forms in island arcs, and you can show that you need water in order to get those things. So what I'm going to show you here is a simplified version of the petrology of the mantle. Ed Stolper would not let me do this if he were here, because this is an inexact representation of what's going on. The trouble is the answer it gives you is almost exactly what the experiments gave you. So I think it's sufficient for me to understand what's going on, and maybe it'll help you understand if you haven't been through this before. Somewhere in the, between drafting this diagram in MacDraw 2 about 15 years ago and transforming it into other things and pasting it in to Excel or PowerPoint, these things have gotten switched around, but you can probably figure out what they are. We'll leave it as a puzzle. So there's experimental data on this system, which is the magnesium N member of forsterite, diopside, quartz, and enstatite plots here. And we're going to pretend that we can add 10% iron, mole percent iron, and treat it as if it were the mantle minerals. And the only thing we'll have left out of this is aluminum, but we'll get most of the, we'll get the major minerals. And the way this diagram works is that this point P, this is the showing the liquidous surface, and in this region here that's labeled olivine, liquids can be in equilibrium with olivine in this field, but they can't be in equilibrium with orthopyroxene or clinopyroxene. In this field, they can be in equilibrium with clinopyroxene, and in this field with orthopyroxene. And the only place that you can have a liquid that's in equilibrium with all three minerals is right at that point. So considering that you start out with a solid that has all three minerals, if you melt it a little bit, the first liquid has to have a composition that plots at this point, because that's the only liquid that can be in equilibrium with those three minerals. So it turns out that you can understand tholeitic and alkali basalts by, if you look at the one atmosphere experiments, if you draw a line between that point and the olivine corner, and Ollie got lost here somewhere along the line. If your liquid plots on this side, if you crystallize olivine, you subtract olivine from the liquid, you move away from it, you'll hit this reactive cotectic here, and peritectic, and you'll end up crystallizing olivine plus orthopyroxene. And with fractional crystallization, you can get all the way over to crystallizing quartz. On the other hand, so this is a sort of definition of tholeitic basalt. And alkali basalt is liquids that are on the other side. So this is a thermal divide here, and the cotectic goes off in this direction because it's not really a three-component system. It's got more in it. So you'd start out crystallizing olivine, then crystallize clinopyroxene, and then go off that way and never have an opportunity to crystallize orthopyroxene or quartz. So that's the essential difference in the way these things crystallize at low pressure, but the reason they're different is because where they were generated at high... Sure. So this is a case of fractional crystallization. Anyway, Okay, so the reason that you get these different liquids is that this sort of paratectic point changes position with pressure. So it starts out close to this clinopyroxene-orthopyroxene join, and at higher and higher pressure it moves off to the upper left. Okay, so I picked a number like 20 kilobars. This is supposed to say high pressure, dry. Pressure equals 20 kilobars. So it moves over this way. So if you melt the mantle at higher pressure, you end up with generating liquids. At higher and higher pressure, they have less of the quartz component in them. So they're more silica poor as you go up in pressure. Okay, so now this is fairly crude, but it actually does illustrate it pretty well. So the typical mantle peridotite would plot down here. It's got a lot of olivine in it. It's got, it's olivine orthopyroxene plus clinopyroxene. So it's got about maybe 15 or 20% clinopyroxene in it and more olivine than orthopyroxene. And so it might plot somewhere in this area. So when it melts, it's going to generate a liquid that plots up here. So this diagram essentially shows you the fundamental reason why when you melt the mantle, you get a liquid that's different. And basically, you get a liquid that's poorer in olivine, much richer in clinopyroxene, and so has much more calcium in it than the mantle, and much less magnesium. Okay. And basically, silica increases in this direction, but exactly where the contours plot depends on how much iron you have in there. okay, so the first liquid to form as the peridotite begins to melt is up there. And then the next question is, well, what if you keep melting it at 20 kilobars? And what you can get out of this diagram is that as you melt this material and you convert it to liquid, and the liquid has to stay at this composition, and the only way you can leave that composition is if you eliminate one of the phases from the solid, because if you get on this line, that's liquid only in equilibrium with olivine and orthopyroxene, so you have to have gotten rid of this clinopyroxene. From the position of this point and this one, you can calculate that the amount of melting you have to do is the length of this line segment divided by the total length of this line segment, which is roughly 20% the way I drew it here. Okay. Actually, the orthopyroxene will plot up here, so it'll be a little bit less than that, but that's a second order issue. So up to 20% melting, you'll still have clinopyroxene in the liquid, in the solid phase, and you have to get up above 20% before you eliminate the clinopyroxene. And then the liquid composition will start to move along here because it has to be in equilibrium with olivine and orthopyroxene still. And up around 40 or 45% melting, you'll get rid of the orthopyroxene too, and your liquid will move into this field. So this is what would happen if you generated the liquid at 20 kilobars. If you bring it up to the surface and... Yeah, well, this was just a continuation of what I said on the other one. So you have to melt a lot in order to eliminate clinopyroxene. And then the solid takes this trajectory, 0% melting, 20% melting, and 40% melting, you only have olivine left. Okay, so now if you bring that up and superimpose that purple curve onto the one atmosphere diagram, you can see that if you melt relatively small amount, you're going to have a liquid. When you bring it up to the surface and crystallize it, it's going to be in the alkali basalt field, which is up here. And the only way you can get into the tholeiite field is if you have more than about 25% melting, that'll bring you down here. And when you bring it up to the surface, it will crystallize. It can crystallize orthopyroxene after olivine. Now, these numbers are not exactly right, but the trend is correct. So actually, you'd have to have the melting percentage be a little bit less than this, but it's still the fact that as you increase the amount of melting at depth, you can still generate tholeiitic basalt, even if the pressure is pretty high. So if we generalize this on this simple diagram, here's pressure in kilobars from 10 to 50, percent melting from 0 to 25, This would be the old lithosphere thickness that corresponds, say, to Hawaii, about 80 or 90 kilometers. And there's a line that goes somewhere in here that if you are in this range of percent melting and depth of average depth of melting, you'll get tholeiitic basalt. And if you're in that range, you get alkali basalt. So at mid-ocean ridges, of course, you're melting at relatively low average pressure. And even if, regardless of how much melting you do, you're going to get tholeiitic basalt pretty much regardless. If you're in old lithosphere, if your melting is anywhere between 0 and about 10%, you're going to tend to make alkali basalt. And the only way you can make tholeiitic basalt is if you have even more melting than that. But you can do that. And in fact, if you sort of superimpose some examples on here, in Hawaii actually, if you read the old petrology textbook, was a classic example of so-called transitional basalt. It straddled the boundary between alkali basalt and tholeiite. It turns out that you get a range from alkali basalt to tholeiite, but the main shield-building lavas are tholeiitic, and they're definitely on this side of this line. And it's because they represent relatively high degrees of melting, because you have this really hot material coming up underneath the thick lithosphere. Tahiti tends to be further over this way. It's not as strong, and the percent melting is probably not as high, so it tends to be mostly alkali basalt. Okay, now, you can make some predictions from the simple model, but actually some people have done experiments to figure out what does happen to the mineral proportions in peridotite. This is an example from a recent paper done in Mark Hirschman's lab, but I don't remember who the first author was, where I mentioned that they did these experiments with diamond chips. They've also done them with vitreous carbon balls. And when they heat this up, the peridotite melts and the liquid gets squeezed out into the interstices between the carbon balls, and they can measure its composition. This is at 1.5 GPA. And the data that's shown here is for a particular composition of a mantle nodule that's relatively depleted in clinopyroxene, so that the initial rock has only about 8 or 9% clinopyroxene in it. So this shows you what happens as you increase the melt fraction from their experimental determinations. Basically, the clinopyroxene content goes almost linearly down to zero at a melt fraction of about 10%. And this is the melt fraction versus temperature diagram. You can see there's a kink in it when you eliminate clinopyroxene. So if you were to go to a somewhat more clinopyroxene-rich composition, which is typical of what pyrolite would be, you would start up here at maybe 15% clinopyroxene, and you would go about linearly down to zero at 20% melting. And this is an example of a more enriched peridotite that they melted here, where you eliminated the CPX at about 22% melting. So it's going to be somewhere in that range, depending on how much CPX you have. Now, if this red curve applied, you would have proportionally less OPX and olivine, so the other two curves would be shifted down a little bit, but really doesn't make all that much difference. And you can see you're not going to eliminate OPX until you get out here somewhere around 30 or 35% melting before you have just olivine left. Okay, so this is fairly general. So if you're talking about small melt fractions, like between 0% melt and 2%, you really don't change the mineralogy of the solid very much. Okay, you do decrease the CPX content by a little bit, but it's not really that big a deal. Now, with regard to those partial melting calculations that Stan was talking about, with regard to calculating the bulk D values, again, assume the initial composition of the solid, you can pretty much guess what the mineral proportions are going to be at 2% melting or 5% melting or 10% melting from the relationships in the phase diagram and from the experiments. So this is not a big uncertainty. The actual D values themselves are probably more of an issue. Okay, so if we look at this simple model of the ridges, where we have a linear increase in melting from 0 to 20%. If we were looking at the lithosphere that comes off of this, this is what we would expect from this model in terms of the clinopyroxene content. So if we started out with the depleted lherzolite, like in the Hirschman experiments, if you started melting it, it actually would start melting a little bit higher up, so this is not exactly right, I don't think. But you'd, whatever you started out with, when you started melting it, you would run the CPX to zero somewhere up there beneath the crust. And for the standard lherzolite model with about 15% CPX in it, it just disappears as you go through the 60 kilometers of oceanic crust, or melting underneath the oceanic crust at ocean ridges. So you should expect this sort of linear decrease. So you have your standard lherzolite down here and gradually depleted, reaching Hartzsprungite up near the top. Now the constraint that we have is basically that you, when you look at ophiolites, the mantle material that's underneath the crustal section is typically Hartzsprungite, which means it doesn't have much CPX in it. Now, that doesn't mean it has zero CPX in it. If you look at the definition of Hartzsprungite, 0 to 5% clinopyroxene still makes you Hartzsprungite. So if you look at where you might expect to be in this diagram, you know, if you, before you melted the standard material, you'd be here in a lherzolite field with maybe 15% clinopyroxene in it. And then as you melt, you preferentially remove the clinopyroxene, a little bit of orthopyroxene, you move off in this direction, eventually get into the Hartzsprungite field. So these are the relationships between how much you melt, how much clinopyroxene is there, and how it should be arranged in the oceanic lithosphere for those simple models. If you go to the Hawaii example again, this is originally was the contours for melt fraction. This would be what the contours would be for CPX content. So out at the edge, you'd have your standard 15% CPX. And in the core of the plume where you melted at 20%, you would have gotten rid of the CPX, essentially, so that you would have something close to Hartzsprungite in that region. Now, I put an asterisk here because you're starting the melting at sufficient depth here that you have garnet in the picture as well. And I haven't given you the simple picture for melting with garnet. Yeah, they would pretty much look like this. Oops. They'd spread out, you know, in the horizontal direction. So if you looked at a cross section through here, something like that, it would look like this. The time, with time at one place or with place, with position? You mean, what would be the difference in the melts here, here, and here?
Yeah, there's that, and then there's also, you know, yeah, I guess. Yeah, so just.
Yeah, I mean, the picture doesn't change with time. It looks exactly like that, and then you just have the stuff flowing through there all the time. This is why I wanted somebody to continue with this geodynamic modeling.
Well, I guess, I mean, part of the reason, well, I guess the other stuff is fly on the bottom, but it's when you're real plume, your conduit, the thermal evolution, the delta available to you in the conduit will be less than in the head, and therefore you shouldn't melt.
This has no head. This is steady state tail.
Yeah.
Right. But the thing that I find interesting that's not been dealt with is the fact that as you bring material up this part of it and start melting it here, it has to percolate up through other material that's been gone through this part and been melted much more. Okay, so it's a fairly complicated situation. And then there could be some residual melt left in this stuff over here that actually went up this limb and went back over the top over to here. It's too much for me to keep track of in my head, and I thought it would be nice to have a geodynamical model where we could impose tracers on the plume, give it radial structure or whatever you wanted, and then see what was melting as first order at each point, aerial view, and then try to keep track of what was happening. I mean, the complication further is that as this material gets generated here, it moves up and reacts with, it doesn't just pass through, but dissolves and reprecipitates the peridotite that is going through. So it's a fairly complicated system. And the idea that we're going to back of the envelope this is, I don't think makes any sense.
You know, I used to think I understood this, now I'm totally perplexed. The scale on the right, the top diagram, is percent melting?
No, I changed the scale. This is CPX. This is inverse of percent melting. It should go from 0% melting to 20% melting. Okay, yeah. Whenever I know that you say you're totally perplexed, I know it's only temporary. Well, the fact is that I've tried to model it in terms of fairly simple models myself, just trying to ignore these complications of the thing turning over and just assuming that all this stuff was one pass through going up. No, they're only from the lithosphere, I think, the ones that do come up. No, there. But the issue of how, if you see some either temporal distribution in isotope ratio in the lavas, like in the drill core in Hawaii, or you see some spatial distribution, how that maps to what was in the plume is determined a lot by what happened to the magma during the process of making it. And it's... I just have the sense that something interesting is going to come out of understanding this at a deeper level. Okay, so I mentioned this already a bit. For the trace element partitioning, we use this expression, and we need to know not only D, which is dependent on the mineralogy, and I sort of discussed a little bit about that situation for ridges, but you also need to decide what F is, and as mentioned, for mid-ocean ridges, when you average F over this entire triangle, for the dry case, basically for the dry or the wet case, you get numbers typically between about 0.05 and 0.1. Even though that, the stuff coming up the axis is getting up to 20%, and what's just going through the edge here is only a little above 0%. So you have a lot of variability down there, and this is a second-order problem that in some cases becomes first order. I think in understanding some of the U-series data at ridges, you have to be have to understand that you've got regions that are undergoing only small amounts of melt, and you may be seeing some of those melts. For Hawaii, it's even a little bit more complicated because, it's a radial thing, so when you average, even though the range is from about 0 to 0.2 like it is at ridges, the mean comes out even a little bit lower, maybe 4% or 5%. But the volcanoes can't sample the whole melting region. We have, at the moment there's 3 active volcanoes. So each one of them sampling, something like a third of the region that's melting down there. So if the volcano is centered over the middle of the plume, it may be getting high degree melts that average 10% the melting or something like that, whereas when it's drifting off the edge, it's getting lower degree melts because it's only sampling the edge of the melting region that's not melting as much. When you look at some of these other, this diagram I showed you once before, it has has, well, here's a mid-ocean ridge basalt, okay? So if you look at these, well, one thing to keep in mind is when we, Stan mentioned that as F goes to zero, this goes to 1 over D. As D goes to zero, it goes to 1 over F. So the absolute maximum amount of enrichment you can get is 1 over the melt fraction, even if the thing is, element is perfectly incompatible. So if you look at the these incompatible elements here for Tristan and Tubuai, they've got 100 times chondrites, so they're enriched relative to primitive mantle by 100 times. So if the source material was somewhere down here or even a little bit below, like we suspect it might be, they're enriched by 100 or 200 times relative to that. So the melt fraction has to be down around 0.005 or something like that, 0.5% or 1%. So this is a constraint on how much melting you're getting. If you look at Hawaii, you see that the enrichment here relative to primitive mantle is around 10. We think that, you know, the Hawaiian mantle may be slightly depleted, so it's an enrichment of about 20, and that would be consistent with a melt fraction of about 5% for the most incompatible elements. For mid-ocean ridges, again, 5 or 6% would put you down. We know that the mantle is depleted, so it's down here somewhere for those. So basically, this model is fairly consistent. And the implication is that for some of these weaker plumes, you don't ever generate, you know, high degrees of melting like you do under Hawaii. And typically, you're getting only a couple of percent melt. And some, a lot of times, the mean value of the melt fraction is only around 1%. Okay, there are other experiments that show this difference between alkali basalt and tholeiitic basalt. Actually, Kushiro did some very extensive experiments in the mid-90s. This again shows, this is a quantitative definition of alkali basalt versus tholeiitic basalt in terms of the normative mineralogy. And the only place, the only time you can get alkali basalt in this little corner up here is if the pressure of melting is high and if the melt fraction is below about 10%. And this is yet another version of the relationship between pressure, melt fraction, temperature, and the kind of lava that you get. Okay. Well, I'll at least do this part. I might be able to squeeze the next two things into about 15 minutes. So this part is taken largely from a presentation that Ed Stolper gave at the Marconi conference last year. One of the issues is that if you recycle oceanic crust into the mantle, you should have this oceanic crustal section, which is basalt. Depending on what pressure you're at, that should be, the rock type should be eclogite or peroxenite in the mantle. And there should be, this stuff gets stirred around, and at, you know, if it's stirred enough, it should be in veins that may be meters or centimeters thick. And in some peridotite out exposures, you can see layers of this peroxenitic material interspersed with Hartzbergite. So the question is, what's the effect of having this material on melting? Well, one of the points that Ed made last year was that the answer to that is partly dependent on what you decide your peroxenite is. Now, this diagram again shows the differences between mantle peridotite and typical mid-ocean ridge basalts. Basalts have a lot less magnesium and they have a lot more aluminum. When you look at things that have been reported in the literature and described as peroxenite, this is where they plot. So there's peroxenites and peroxenites. And if you want to know what the effect of melting a peroxenite is, you'll have to specify exactly what its composition was. He also went on to show that, in fact, if you plot them up on this representation, which is calcium, magnesium, aluminum, silica, tetrahedron, and then he's cut a triangle out of the middle of it there. There's a thermal divide in the way these things, the melting happens in this system. And so if you have rocks that have compositions that plot below this dashed line, the initial melts are at the end of these three little lines down here. Okay, so this is the silica corner up here. So these things are relatively silica poor. They melted from rocks that have a fair amount of silica in them, they're like these basalts, but the liquids that produce for them have less silica than the rocks that they started out with. If you're just on the other side of this divide, when you melt these things, you make melts of very high silica. Okay, so there's a very sensitive change here depending on what composition you get. So some people, for instance, have looked at lavas currently coming out of Mauna Loa and noticed that they have relatively high silica contents. So people have proposed that the reason that they have high silica contents is that you're preferentially getting liquid from melting of these eclogenic veins in the Hawaiian plume, and at Mauna Loa you're sampling some part of the plume that's got a lot of these veins in it. And people have made similar arguments for other places. The real issue, I think, is this one, that if you compare the solidest temperature of most eclogites and peroxenites, they tend to be lower than the melting temperature of dry peridotite, and consequently, if they're there, they start melting at a lower temperature. Again, Ed pointed out, not all of them have this feature. Some of them are not much different from the peridotites, but. And what this means is that as you do the adiabatic upwelling, you'll reach a temperature where the peroxenites start melting prior to where you reach the temperature where the peridotite starts melting. And this generates a whole range of possibilities for what could happen. But in general, like under a ridge, as you cycle things up, you'll get the peroxenite veins melting first down here, and you won't start melting the peridotite until you get up higher. But the questions you have to ask are, if you start melting the peroxenites, can that melt escape without interacting with the rest of the rock or not? And under what conditions would that be possible? He made another point here that there's some further thermal interaction, that if you were melting the peroxenite by itself and you were coming up an adiabat and reached the solidus, the pure peroxenite would follow this green line here. It melts pretty fast as you bring it up. It has a fairly narrow melting interval. The problem is that the adiabatic upwelling model assumes that all you have is your peroxenite plus your melt. If you have your peroxenite embedded in the Hartzbergite, which is not melting, the Hartzbergite is going up the solid adiabat. It's not cooling, okay, any faster than a third of a degree per kilometer. So your peroxenite would like to go off on this other trend here where it's melting, but it's going to exchange heat with its surroundings, and it's not going to be going on that trajectory. So it'll be going on some other trajectory here, which will make it melt even faster. So this is an interesting sidelight. But the other thing is that you'll end up delaying a little bit the initiation of melting of the peridotite. So the peridotite will be coming up this red line, normally would start melting here, but because it's being cooled by the melting of the peroxenite, it won't hit until here. So you'll get some extra melt from melting the veins, and you'll delay melting of the peridotite. And Ed argued that if you took standard lairzolite and melted it and compared that to a situation where you separated the lairzolite into veins that were pyroxene-rich and more Hartzbergitic stuff that was pyroxene-poor, but so that the bulk composition was the same, the net result is, much like with water, it's the difference between this red line and the purple line. Purple line would be the standard lairzolite melting, melt fraction versus pressure as you're coming up. This would probably be 1350 degree adiabat or potential temperature. If you have the peroxenite in there, you start melting at a much higher pressure, but you don't get much melt. It's much like water. And once you get to about 10% or 15% melt, you're pretty much in the same place you would have been anyway. Okay. So again, if you've got a situation where you're just barely grazing the region where the temperature region where the mantle is going to melt, the veins make a difference. If you're going to get your melt fractions up to 15 or 20% anyway, they only make a little difference. So once you get up to this region here with the peroxenite, you get, you know, maybe couple of percent additional melt. Instead of 10%, maybe you get 12%. So again, you can't, you know, make huge magmatic provinces just by melting these peroxenites. You can enhance the melting a little bit. You can get your extra 20 or 30% of liquid by having them there. Okay, last thing. We might as well do this while we're at it. Okay, so we've been talking as if the melt magically gets out as you produce it, as the mantle's moving up. And this problem has been dealt with in the literature for about 20 years, starting with a paper by McKenzie in 1984, I think it was. And it's gotten renewed interest because it turns out that the U-series isotopes help you to get some of the time scales and help you to constrain some of the parameters that you need for it. And this is a picture that comes off of Mark Spiegelman's website, where he's got a program that you can run online to calculate U-series isotope effects that you get from melting at different rates and for different porosities. So the basic idea, the simple model, which is not does not cover 100% of the physics, is that you have material that's coming up adiabatically at some level, corresponds to a pressure or depth. It starts melting, which is where it crosses the mantle solidus, and then it continues upward, usually, and moves off to the side as well. And at some point, at up a lower pressure limit, it stops melting. And the two parameters that you have here is the upward solid upwelling velocity, which is the capital W, and the rate at which the melt's percolating through the solid, which is small W. And for the this stuff all comes from the U series. And for his model, he's got two different melting rates here, which sort of simulate having water available. Okay. So in the simple model of melt fraction versus height or depth, you'll start melting when you cross the solidus. You stop melting at the thickness of the melt region is D, and you'll reach some maximum melt fraction. And the assumption in his model, Spiegelman's model, is that you linearly increase melt fraction as you go up. So you have a constant upwelling velocity and a constant melting rate. There's a couple of simple conservation statements that you can make, that the melt that's moving up at steady state, you're pumping things through this melting region constantly. At some level here, the melt that's flowing through that level has to be equal to the amount of melt that's being generated below it. Okay, that's the top diagram. Then there's a couple of other ones, conservation of mass here. End up with the melting rate is just the function of the maximum F divided by the thickness of the melting region. So he parameterizes it in terms of the melt fraction and the upward velocity. And if we go to the next slide, you'll see, well, okay. So what determines how fast the melt moves? Well, it's a form of Darcy's law, where essentially the melt flux here was phi times the relative velocity of the melt relative to the solid is a permeability constant divided by the viscosity at times some function of the porosity and the buoyancy of the melt. Okay, so basically the velocity of the melt typically is assumed to go something like this: the density contrast times about phi squared. Although what you end up here for an exponent depends on what model you like, and it's inversely proportional to the viscosity of the liquid. And it boils down to this relationship, which is very neat, that the ratio of the upwelling velocity to the solid upwelling velocity is just proportional to the ratio of the total amount of melting divided by the local permeability. So if this profile looks like this, where F is increasing linearly, but the porosity, it looks like this, then the, and let's say in the upper part of this column, the ratio of F to phi is about 10, You plug that in here, multiply it by the ratio of the solid density to the fluid density, and you get the ratio of the liquid velocity to the solid velocity being about 12. So the whole idea is that because permeability increases very rapidly with phi, it goes like phi squared or even higher power of phi, you don't have to get up to very high porosities to allow a whole lot of melt to flow through. And the smaller your assumption is about phi relative to F, the faster the melt must be moving up. Okay. So the problem with the model is you don't have a whole lot of constraints on the actual permeability of the mantle. If you've ever dealt with modeling, groundwater modeling, you know that if you have to estimate permeabilities of sandstones or anything else, usually there's an uncertainty of a couple of orders of magnitude or something like that. It's very difficult to do. Permeability is notoriously difficult to estimate. So the idea is that maybe the U-series isotopes will help with this. It's dependent on the porosity is the melt fraction that's present. Okay, so you're generating the melt, and it's the whole system is self-consistent. You maintain only as much porosity as it takes to allow the rock to be permeable enough for the melt to escape.
So all the any part that's melted is defined as porosity.
Say
that? The melt fraction is basically defined as the porosity.
The melt fraction that's present in the rock at any time is that, but the total amount of melting is a different thing.
Yeah. Which
okay. It's a big F, right. If you want to keep track of chemical elements and how they're moving through the melt column, this is essentially an ion exchange column. If it's the liquid's moving through the solid and the solid's interacting with the melt, then the propagation of concentration of elements, say trace elements, through the melt column is going to depend on their distribution coefficient between the liquid and the solid. So this is the sort of governing equation for what's going to happen to concentrations, and you can also cast it in terms of isotope ratios. And you can potentially get a lot of interesting things. I mean, elements with small d's will go through the melt column at roughly the liquid velocity. Things that are held in the solid more strongly will be retarded. So, for instance, you can get different elements like radiogenic elements like neodymium versus helium or something like that can be separated in the melt column if you have this going on. If you have radiogenic and radioactive elements like uranium and its daughter products, they also move through the column at different rates depending on their distribution coefficients. And this is the basis of using U-series to get some idea of how fast things are going on in the melting process. So this is the bottom line, is that the effective velocity of an element in the liquid is related to, so let's say if you subtract this from that, that's the velocity of the element relative to the solid is equal to the velocity of the liquid relative to the solid times this factor. So the important ratio is the ratio of the distribution coefficient to the porosity. Okay. So since they think the porosities are typically around 0.1% or 0.1%, so the D value has to be something like 10^-3 in order to be going through fast. And if it's even 10^-2, it's being retarded significantly. So here's an example of what happens in a melt column from the bottom to the top in this paper by Spiegelman and Elliott. So this is what they have for the porosity. So they start out at zero, and it goes up only to 0.1%. Okay, and these are the concentrations in the fluid divided by what they start out with in the first little bit of melt, and shows the activity ratios here. Now what they found is that because you have different half-lives and different of both the daughters and the parents, you can get dependence on the upwelling velocity and the porosity. And you typically get these kinds of plots where if you look at the ratio of thorium-230 to 238, which is typically around 1 or a little bit higher, if you have upwelling velocities going from a millimeter per year to a meter per year, and this is what your assumed porosity is, this is what you predict for the thorium-230 to 238 uranium ratio coming out at the top of the column. Okay. So what you have is a region up here for upwelling velocities between about a few centimeters and a meter per year. This is where the D for thorium is, so you should be in this range. You'll have a dependence of this ratio on the upwelling velocity. So they made the argument that you can calculate the upwelling velocity of the solid from what's coming out. Radium, on the other hand, is mainly sensitive, because there's a short half-life, it's mainly sensitive to the porosity. So the idea, which is pretty neat if you believe it, is that you can use the radium to tell you the porosity and then use the uranium-thorium ratio to tell you the upwelling velocity. So look at these numbers here. 1.05 would give you, for these parameters, maybe 20 or 30 centimeters per year. And then 1.15 would give you something like a few or 5 centimeters per year. And look at some of the data from the Galapagos for that number. And you can see that this is, Alberto Sal presented this last year too. And I don't know which paper this is from. He didn't have the, oh, it's not published yet. Okay. This should go no further than 2 websites. So again, in the center here, which is where the most active volcanoes are, you get numbers that are a little bit below 1.05. So this would be upwelling velocities in the tens of centimeters per year. And then it drops off to numbers like 1.15, which would be a few centimeters per year. Now, Ken Sims did a similar thing for Hawaii and got a similar range. This is from a paper a while back, which shows what should be the generalization from this. I don't know how well this holds up with more data, but and actually they don't have Hawaii plotted in the right place, of course. So you put Hawaii back here, and then you get back here. It's only at 3, right? Or maybe you can count 4. But maybe the other ones are wrong too, for all I know. Although the plate velocities are not as high for the other ones, I don't think. So there's some relationship, you might argue, between buoyancy flux and this ratio. The larger the buoyancy flux, the more hot material you have coming up at a higher rate. Presumably, then you should have higher melting rates and higher upwelling rates. So it would just finish this off by reminding you that when people talk about upwelling rates, this is not any different from talking about melting rates, because the melting rate's determined by the upwelling rate. All right, okay. The faster you upwell, the faster you melt. So the early papers on this are talking in terms of melting rates, and the later ones talk in terms of upwelling rates. Okay, last trick. If we go back to this diagram, if we make our melts at 20 kilobars and they have this composition, and we move them up through the mantle at lower and lower pressures, the equilibrium value or composition of the melt is over here. So these melts that come from depth as they're moving through the shallow mantle are not in equilibrium with the mantle. Relative to the equilibrium liquid, they have, they're too far off in this direction. They're too silica poor. So what these melts do in contact with the solid that's around them is they tend to crystallize olivine. They crystallize olivine, they'll move closer to the equilibrium, and they'll dissolve pyroxene. And I think largely what they do is dissolve pyroxenes, because if you take some combination of orthopyroxene and clinopyroxene and dissolve it and add it to the liquid, it'll move you in this direction. So basically these liquids that are generated at depth are corrosive as they go up through the upper part of the mantle. And this creates a very interesting dynamical situation. It's very similar to the problem of a melting glacier in the formation of tubes in a melting glacier, in that where you have regions where you have preferential flow of melt, the melt flows through there faster and tends to dissolve the material around it fast, and it increases the size of the melt channel. And so you have spontaneous generation of high porosity channels for the melt to go through. So Spiegelman and Kellerman have gone through a model, and this you can run this model on Spiegelman's website, and it'll do this. I didn't try to download the movie, but basically from just a background slight heterogeneity in the permeability, you generate these melt channels, and then the melt is focused in these channels. This doesn't show what isn't labeled very well. And this is a model for an actual ridge. So this is half of a ridge with the solid flow being like this. And you generate these channels, and some of them get focused up to the ridge, and some of them gets focused off the ridge. And then when you look at how the mantle's been depleted in terms of, say, trace elements, incompatible trace elements, you see you get this very heterogeneous depletion pattern. You still get a general zonation from bottom to top, where you have more depleted stuff at the top and less depleted stuff at the bottom, but you also have this other structure that's generated by this effect. The other point here is that with regard to this idea of melt columns acting as ion exchange columns, if you've ever done ion exchange column chemistry, you know that the worst thing is to have heterogeneity in your resin. You don't want any little channels in your resin, because you're going to get bad separation of your elements if you're trying to separate them on the column. So when you have these melt channels, this has a tendency to very efficiently mix melts that are derived from down here and zipped up these channels with melts that are added into the channel from the side by compaction up at the top. So you have a lot of vertical averaging in this kind of picture. And one thing I mentioned in the last talk, and that hasn't been followed through on yet, is that this process may happen at mid-ocean ridges, and it's possible it doesn't happen in mantle plumes, just because of the fact that it happens deeper and you don't have the same chemistry contrast, and also the rates are a little bit different. So it could be that at mid-ocean ridges, because of this kind of process, you do a lot better job of averaging the geochemical heterogeneities over the whole depth of the melting region. And in plumes, you do a less good job of averaging those heterogeneities. And I think that's the last overhead. Thanks. Anybody got anything left?
Don, if there's a peroxide in the mantle, where might it come from, and how much would you?
Well, the way I would answer the question is I would look at the generation of oceanic lithosphere. And so for the standard model, Planck and Langmuir, you have 66 kilometers. You have 60 kilometers of Hartzbergite and Laerzeleite and 6 kilometers of oceanic crust. So if you believe that, the ratio should be 1 to 10. But if you haven't processed all of that stuff, then it should be less. Okay, so if there's a lot of the mantle you haven't processed through the mid-ocean ridge, like half of it or something, then maybe there's only 5% veins. Actually, for the one-dimensional column without the channels, it turns out to be exactly the same as batch melting for the trace element chemistry. For the columns, it's probably not a whole lot different. The main difference between the columns is that in the one-dimensional porous flow model, all the melt reaching the top is the same, you know, because it's horizontally, there's no difference in the model. Okay, here you have horizontal differences, because what's coming up the channels is melt that's actually the flow in the channels is laminar. These things are not actually open fractures, they'll just high permeability zones made up mostly of olivine grains. So they just have higher permeability, but if you, higher porosity. But since porosity goes like, or permeability goes like porosity squared or to the 2.5, they have really high permeability. So the flow in them is laminar. So what's coming up the middle of the tube is melt that's generated down here. You can still find it almost unadulterated in the middle of the channel. And what's at the edges of the channel is melt that's being squeezed out of the interchannel matrix. So they argue that as you do a cross-section, geochemical cross-section across the channel, you'll have a huge variability in trace element concentrations from the middle to the edges. What has been seen is if you measure melt inclusions in olivines, people have found that a small proportion of these things have very large amplitude geochemical heterogeneity. And the answer is, how would you preserve it at all in a melting column if you had very efficient averaging? So they argue only from here that it's possible to deliver very heterogeneous melt to the top of the melting region by this process. What was your next comment? You don't believe it?
How wide are these channels?
Meters, I think.
Well, you mean in the field or in the computer?
They're scaled, but I think they're meters in the field, aren't they? A meter or a few meters? Or so? Up to tens. Okay. Yeah, there are outcrop scale features. I didn't reproduce that figure, but there's a picture of the outcrop in Oman with Peter Kellman for scale.
Left and right, one is flow rate and the other one is...
This is the concentration of an incompatible element. This shows that the incompatible elements are concentrated in the melts that are in the channels. And this is, again, this I think the same thing, which shows that the channel regions up at the top have been depleted in the incompatible element relative to the bottom. And in general, the upper part of the section is depleted relative to the bottom part of the section, I think. But just type in Mark Spiegelman's name and go to the website and you can look at the movies. These things move around with time, you know, they're time-dependent features. They're great, but the model, the computer model is very simple. He's got a one-component system that he just dissolves solid and makes it into liquid. It's only one thing going on. It doesn't have the phase equilibria in it.